Okay, this is Gary Parrish again from CBSSports.com again, and let me welcome you back to the Iowa College Basketball Podcast, which is now brought to you by Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes it fast and easy to create your own professional website or online portfolio. For a free trial and 10% off, go to squarespace.com/CBSSports. Use the offer code FUN. That's FUN at squarespace.com/CBSSports. All right, let's get into it. The Final Four is now over. College basketball season is now over. We had planned to do another podcast on the Tuesday after the national championship game, but that is a travel day, and we were all exhausted. Plus, Matt Norlander had been spent the early hours of Tuesday stomping on a homeless person in Dealey Plaza. We'll get to that in just a moment for certain. But first, let me welcome Jeff Borzello and Matt Norlander. How are you, fellas?
I'm fantastic. I slept for 10 hours last night.
I tried to go to bed early. I went to bed at like 9 o'clock. Like,
you didn't watch the women's game, Parrish?
I did not watch the women's game. I apologize. Should I? Sure. Should I have watched it?
Yeah. It's Oriana's ninth championship.
Oh, should I? See, I
couldn't tell you anything about it, but I know what happened.
Yeah, I didn't watch it. I don't want to say I've never watched a women's basketball game. That's not true. When you're young, like when I was your age, Borzello, you would end up covering, when you're working at a newspaper, you know, a random women's basketball game here or there. But I've never followed the sport closely, although I am familiar with Gino Auriemma. I know who he is.
I had to talk about it on Leadoff last night, so I had to watch some of it.
Yeah, they
let me drop that in there. No big deal.
They asked me to go on Leadoff last night before you.
They also asked me. And I
said, you were the third pick, Borzello.
You guys don't have the expertise I have on Gino Auriemma.
No, the truth is I could not, and I just could, like, you know, this is the great thing about being single. Or one of the great things about being single is that when you get home, you don't really have any responsibilities. Like, I'd been gone for like 7 straight nights. I can't come home and then say I gotta take a shower and put on a sport coat and talk to Allie LaForce on Skype I've just been on the road forever. I had to spend time with the family, and of course I tried to do that when I got home, and then I fell asleep at like 9 o'clock, and then guess what happened? Woke up at like 12:30, was up till like 4 a.m. Couldn't go back to sleep. I couldn't sleep consecutive hours.
That's unfortunate. That you're not well rested yet.
I'm not well rested. No, I'm not well rested at all. I'm still tired as hell. In fact, I gotta go. I gotta get a nap in right now.
Okay, well, Borzello and I can take over the podcast, and we'll wake you up halfway through.
Yeah, we'll crush it. No big deal.
Norlander, do you want to explain why you stomped on a homeless man after the national championship game in Dealey Plaza?
They got it.
Is this what we really want to like? We want to.
That was one of the highlights.
There were many highlights. I promise we're going to talk plenty about basketball, but I
don't make promises. You don't know that's true.
Wow. You don't want to promise that we're going to talk basketball.
I never really know where we're going to end up with.
We're going to talk about historians and homeless people.
We're going to talk about you stomping on a homeless. That guy has been
You know what? Hold on. Okay, you didn't even see it happen. If I hadn't said anything, you wouldn't have even known about it, okay? Because you and Borzello were hiding behind the fence like the second shooter.
We were trying to see the angle from what the second shooter would have been.
We were trying to crack this conspiracy, Norlander. Yeah.
Sorry, we're trying to figure out mysteries, man.
Sorry, we're trying to figure out how the president was killed.
You know what? That's a fresh angle. So the title game ends, and we're riding back in the car with Goodman, who we basically used because he was the only one that had a rental car. He thought he was like back in the gang. Little did he know that he was basically our easy ride. So we're riding back, and Parrish is like, yeah, it's Dealey Plaza right there. Let's go. So it's 2:40 in the morning.
That's not true. Let me stop you right there.
That is true.
Here's what happened. You guys have never been to Dealey Plaza because I'm a red-blooded American. I've been to Dealey Plaza multiple times in my life. And so you guys have been talking all week about we got to go to Dealey Plaza. We got to go by and see the grassy knoll. And you had never done it because you were out drinking every night and sleeping in every day. And so finally, for you guys, I said, listen, I know how badly you've wanted to go by Dealey Plaza this whole week. This is your last opportunity. It is right there if you want to drive over there. And so I was merely opening a door so that you guys
could really wanted to see it. I was pumped. I wanted to see it all week, but Goodman never wanted to go see it.
Because he was drinking all every night and sleeping and in as well.
He doesn't care about American right, history.
So he doesn't care about American history.
We pull up to Dealey Plaza at 2:45 in the morning, and it's kind of eerie and creepy, and just like the fact that we're there at that time. And it's a simple, like, it's kind of, you know, when you hear about some historical sites, they can be so, I don't know, small, or just you get what I'm saying. Like, it's just like right there in a kind of an open spot. And next to the grassy knoll, like, there's two X's in the ground in the road where Kennedy was shot. And then there's a grassy knoll. And then how would you describe what that structure is that you kind of walk through? I don't know how to describe it.
The grassy knoll?
No, the wall with all the stuff there. How would you describe what that is?
I would just describe it as I would have left that out of the story.
Yeah. Okay, you would. It's essential to the story.
I would have talked about the X in the middle of the road.
There's a structure there, and the point is, there was a homeless man that was blending in with his surroundings because he was nudged up against the wall in the darkness. I could not see him. I went to go take a photo of the perspective of basically right in front of where you two were creeping out, maybe making out behind this fence.
Hey.
It was bizarre. I give it two more days.
I didn't see him even after you pointed it out.
And Norlander, let me ask you a question. And I'm being serious right now. What does it say about you that you don't even notice homeless people lying on the ground anymore?
Dude, he was a ninja, okay?
He's a ninja.
I did not see him at all.
Have you become so numb to poverty in our country? Staying in your five-star hotels, ordering your room service, going to your private parties, sitting courtside at the Final Four. Have you become so numb to poverty in our country?
They're just speed bumps to him.
Yeah, that you don't even notice. Like, that man has been through it. He has reached a point in his life where he's lying on the ground in public just trying to get his sleep on.
Trying to figure out the JFK mystery.
Just trying to figure out what happened. And you just so, like, you don't even notice it. You don't even notice it. You just step right on his head.
It wasn't his head. It was, I think, a calf.
Oh, how would you know?
Because I felt the firmness of bone, basically.
Oh, wow.
And then it creeped me the hell out. And I apologized to him. I couldn't tell if he was conscious or not. And then basically ran as far away as possible. It wasn't
Kind of freaked out. You were like shaking. You were like shaking your feet and shaking your whole body.
So let me ask another question then. What does it say about you that you will stomp on a man and then run away without stopping even for a moment to say, sir, can I help you? Is there anything I could do to maybe?
Well, a couple of things. One, I did apologize to him. Two, if it had been you, I don't even think you would have gone that far with it.
No, I help people all the time.
Oh, do you?
Yeah.
Okay. Parish would have offered him a hot meal.
A hot meal, warm meal.
There's no chance that would have happened. And I give it until Friday before Goodman posts that photo of you two behind the fence at Dealey Plaza.
Yeah, over there investigating like we're true detectives.
Yeah.
Yeah, like the Hardy Boys, more like it.
We're back there acting like Woody Harrelson and Matthew McConaughey trying to figure this thing out.
I'll be McConaughey.
Yeah, you probably are McConaughey. in the if we're assigning roles, you're probably McConaughey. I'll give you that.
All right, so you want to talk about these games?
Oh, yeah, Connecticut won a national championship. That was something, wasn't it?
They won two national championships.
Oh, well, yeah, the other one I forgot about. Anyway, yeah, congratulations to the women as well.
Yeah, that was pretty wild, right? I mean, honestly, kind of ridiculous that UConn's won two of the past four. I mean, it's actually amazingly ridiculous. But, hey, it's the best program in the past 15 years now, right?
To win two out of four, go on probation, and have to change coaches is pretty crazy.
It is absolutely insane. I mean, it's like when you think about this team that won, and then consider like the 99 and 04 teams, I mean, just totally different kind of teams in different eras. But over that decade and a half span, I mean, UConn has really become the most prestigious program in college hoops, right? I mean, no one has
many titles.
No, that's
not true. That's not
you know
true.
Why? Okay, so
I think they're the most successful in the past century.
Yeah, yeah. Like, so why don't you believe that's true? I mean, they're clearly a top five program when you turn and look at the coach they have, the pros they put in, the success they've had in the tournament. They made another Final Four, so they've been to five. They go one out of every 3 years. Meanwhile, you know, Duke's been right there. Kentucky's mostly been right there, but it had some down years. So why isn't Connecticut the top program of the past 15 years?
Oh, if you want to, I'm sure you could come up with a bullet point resume that would suggest they're the most successful. But to try to use the word prestigious, and I don't think it even comes close. I mean, like, all I know,
prestige doesn't always have to do with how successful you are.
Well, that's like, fair. That's a bad choice of word, right?
Yeah, there. Like if you, I know this. If you take what you know, your mid-major basketball team, and you are suddenly able to schedule a home-and-home with, like, a high-major team, and it's, like, the biggest moment in the history of your program, and you can get anybody coming in. What excites your fans more? North Carolina does. Duke does. Kentucky does. I think Kansas probably does. Like, there's, I think there's a handful of teams.
Yeah, that, but yeah, and those teams are also, yeah, because, yeah, now we're talking two different things, because those programs have decades upon decades of history that, you know, go with their name, while Calhoun built nothing out of farmland into just this ridiculous program. Like, it is silly that UConn is this good at both men's and women's basketball.
No, it's all, like, you've been there? Of course you've been there, right?
That's
the place you build two basketball powers is pretty ridiculous. Yeah. Yes. No, I'll give you that. I just think that when the word prestigious means maybe something different to me than...
Yeah, no, I meant over the past 15 years now, it's got, you know, more bragging rights than anyone, because it's got more titles, it's got that extra Final Four, all those pros with a Hall of Fame coach, and now with another coach who did it mostly with Calhoun's players, but still, like, for him to have done this with this team, which I don't think is as good as the 2011 team.
And you said earlier, like last week, that the 2011 team was the worst national championship team ever. So that now that's the second worst, and this one's the worst. This one's the absolute worst.
I don't know about that. I don't think I said it was. I said it was one of the worst.
You think which team you think was better this year, 2011?
2011 team, I think, was better, because I would say Kemba was better than Shabazz, but Shabazz was unreal, and I think that Oriaki was pretty solid. Yeah, I would take the 2011 group. It had a better year. This was a seven seed, the first seven seed ever to win the title.
Tyler Olander got more minutes on that team,
which is wild, right? Freshman Tyler Olander versus senior Tyler Olander, and freshman Tyler Olander was better. And just weird.
I love Tyler Olander. He became my go-to quote over the weekend.
He was great.
Yeah, anytime I need somebody to give me the perfect quote, I just go to Tyler Olander. He was awesome. Like my favorite Husky outside of Shabazz. Speaking of Shabazz, what did you guys make of his post-game moment on the stage just before one shining moment with Jim Nantz? Jim Nantz asked him basically, what's it like to fulfill your dreams? And Shabazz hit him with a, let me get everybody's attention. What did you make
Seriously,
of that?
I mean, that was awesome. Like a wedding, like in terms of getting everyone's attention from a wedding toast angle. Borzella, did you want to take it though?
I mean, I didn't have a comparison to a wedding toast, but...
you know what I'm saying, though? He's like, I need everyone to be quiet, please. Be quiet. Because he wanted everyone to hear. That was...
It was a statement. It was a big-time... I mean, I think it was kind of perfect. Because, you know, it's you know, kind of what they were. You know, they were basically forgotten a year ago. And because of the NCAA, nobody really cared about them, just aside from the whole Jim Calhoun thing. But, you know, it was... I don't know. I thought it was kind of perfect. I know it got some controversy, but I thought it was perfect.
It was perfect because we don't have college athletes that are now, maybe because Napier, I wonder if Napier's a junior and they do that, you know, and they're not banned, whatever, just in that kind of situation. If he wasn't going to come back for a year, if he still makes that kind of statement, but he knows that, you know, that's his final game. He's never going to play in a UConn uniform again. Right. And he's willing to make that kind of statement. We don't get players that say that kind of stuff ever. Forget about after winning a title and talking to millions of people across the country. I admire the hell out of him for doing it, to be honest. I mean, and his wording was very particular. He had this whole Hungry Huskies thing, which is a double entendre.
Love Hungry
Huskies. About whether, you know, he ever went to bed hungry, but the point is he was kind of getting a greater message across there. So for him to do that, and GP, you wrote, you know, you dedicated your post-game column to it, I thought it was absolutely terrific, and I wish more players would be willing to be as outspoken as Napier was in that moment. And Napier had been outspoken to a lesser degree leading up to it, but I think we'd see more change and impact and discussion about the things he was talking about if we had more high-profile players in basketball and football willing to say that stuff.
I thought it was terrific for those reasons on that stage. I've talked to some people. I was on with John Feinstein earlier today, and he loved that Shabazz tried to make a point, didn't think that was the proper place to make that point. And I thought it was the perfect place because right. You will never again. I mean, you could do it in a Sunday afternoon breakout room, right? And at AT&T Stadium, but you're never going to have that stage again where you've got 80,000 fans in the building looking at you. You've got literally millions, tens of millions across the world looking at you. And that is, and I didn't get into all of this in the column, but, you know, given where we're at with the NCAA, there was a quote that surfaced yesterday from John Calipari comparing the NCAA to the old Soviet Union and saying, listen, you know, it still existed. It was still strong. It could still hurt you, but you could see it crumbling and getting to a point to where it was going to have to change or cease to exist. That's what the NCAA is now. And though I don't always agree with everything John says, I think that's a pretty good comparison. You look at the NCAA now, you can see it crumbling. They're going to have to change in a significant way or cease to exist. And so, I thought it was, you know, given that that's the sort of the landscape of the NCAA right now, and Mark Emmert held a press conference literally 24 hours earlier at which he made himself look silly again, not because he's a dumb man or an unintelligent man or an unreasonable man, but because he makes millions of dollars off of the current system. And so you say what you got to say. Like Bill Hancock, the guy who is the spokesperson for once upon a time the BCS, now the College Football Playoff, he's the sweetest man in the world. And he used to consistently make himself look stupid by trying to defend the BCS and telling you how college football would crumble if you ever had a playoff. And then what happened? We get a playoff, and they hire him to say good things about the playoff. So now he's saying good things about the playoff. And it sort of is what it is. So I don't think Mark Emmert's dumb. You get that a lot. Like, Mark Emmert's an idiot. No, Mark Emmert's not an idiot. Mark Emmert's smarter than me, smarter than you. He's smarter than most people. But he's in charge of a I think the phrase we decided to use the other night in Orlando of a morally dubious organization. And so he says what he has to say. But the idea that he has to say these things and he has to address these things, and you get the possible unionization of Division I athletes at Northwestern and all of this, the Ed O'Bannon
lawsuit.
That's the
key. That's the backdrop to what Napier was saying.
Right.
Like just 2 days, 3 days prior, like Emmert had to give his annual State of the Union and State of the, you know, NCAA Union speech. So this comes at a particularly tender time because as we pass on with each year, guys, I mean, more and more criticism toward the NCAA, a little bit more NCAA kind of realizing what it is and how it can't stay the way it is. So that's why it was the absolute perfect time for Napier to say what he did when he did it.
Exactly. And that moment, that stage, it should be, given that the NCAA doesn't actually have control over the national championship game in football, that is probably the most innocent and biggest of all direct NCAA, you know, directly attached NCAA moments, right? You've got the NCAA president standing on a stage. You've got confetti everywhere. We're about to do one shining moment where you see all these kids crying and hustling and playing for the love of their school. It is the most innocent moment, or it's supposed to be the most innocent visible moment in college athletics. And yet you take Shabazz Napier and he just, you know, he shits on it, for lack of a better word. And could he have made his point more eloquently? Of course he could have. Could he have made his point more clearly? Surely he could have. It turned into little more than, you know, a wrestler yelling into a television camera, you know, this is what happens when you banned us, you know, like, so there's a better way to do it, I think. But if the point is to make a point, he made a point. And to get into a conversation about who was at fault for the APR ban, I think is to miss the point entirely. And that's what you got into a little bit. I saw some people, you know, talking about, well, you know, it's UConn's play, you know, it's UConn's fault that they, you know, were banned from the tournament, not the NCAA's. And I get that, right? You got to work really hard to actually get banned because of a poor APR. I mean, you got to really, really work hard by not working hard to end up in that situation. But I think his larger point, I know because I talked to him afterward. His main point was that, you know, don't punish us for things that had nothing to do with us. And I actually get that on some level. Like Shabazz Napier is not the reason the AP, you know, the Connecticut was banned from last year's postseason. These are things that happen for the most part under a different coach and with different players. And so I understand that frustration. Then his larger point, and I, you know, he didn't verbalize this very well. But his larger point also was like, get out of here with your whole, you know, we care about academic stuff. And to me, and this is what I spent most of the column writing about, it's to me, it's just another highlighted hypocrisy that, you know, the NCAA only has APR bans and that APR thing because they want to pretend as an organization that they care about academics, right? They don't really care about academics. They care about pretending they care about academics. Because if you really cared about academics, two things. One, you wouldn't let it in North Carolina get away with an incredibly, you know, egregious academic scandal rooted in athletics. They've done nothing about that, all right? So if you cared about academics, you'd start it in Chapel Hill. B, if you care about academics, like how long is it? You guys have been in school more recently than me. How long is a typical college semester? Give it to me. Middle of January to what?
Oh, till beginning
my, my was early February until mid-May. Or so
okay,
like four
so
months.
Okay, so four
three
months, right?
3.5 months. 3.5, 4 months.
Let's call it four, just because it's easy to do. Let's the division. We're going to call it four. Well, the Connecticut basketball team has spent the past 4 weeks in Memphis, Buffalo, New York, and Dallas. That's roughly a month. That's roughly 25% of the semester. So if you genuinely care about academics, why do you have a setup that pulls student, quote, student athletes away from their campuses and classrooms for a solid month? Now, I know you can get a lot of work done on a computer and online classes and all that.
Tutors travel with the team and that.
I got all that, right? But, like, I also have seen the NCAA allow schools, because ESPN says we'll put it on television, to start games on school nights at 2 a.m., midnight. 11 p.m., whatever. And so if you care about academics, you know who cares about academics? The Ivy League. You know why? When do they play their games?
Friday, Saturday.
They play their games on Friday night and Saturday because we're not going to miss school. You know why? Because we care about academics. So if an Ivy League president or Ivy League athletic director wanted to stand up and say, we care about academics, I'm in no good position to argue with him, because they're actually – you know what the way that they handle things actually reflects that. But when you've got college basketball players flying all over the country midweek, tipping off games literally at 2 a.m. local time on a Tuesday, when you've got basketball players kept away from classrooms for the most part for four straight weeks in the middle of the semester, when you're flying teams in on Wednesday afternoon for games that don't tip till Saturday night, don't try to tell me you care about academics. And so it was just another highlighted hypocrisy. And again, there's probably a better way for Shabazz to put it, but he made a point in a very public way, and it led to a conversation.
And that's
good enough.
I want to just really quickly point out that someone, GP asked the question in the post game. I think you had the first question, and then you talked to him solo in the locker room after. But at the press conference, he said that this was premeditated. He mentioned he was laying down thinking about what he'd say
on Sunday, right? Yeah.
So this was not like we won. He had thought about this, and I think that speaks largely to it as well.
And I love that. Like, it wasn't just some off the cuff. We're the hungry Huskies or whatever.
Hungry hippos.
Yeah, or the hungry hippos. I wouldn't mind if he said hungry hippos. You want me to tell you the truth? He actually told me that he laid down on Sunday, and because I knew when that moment happened, I knew that's what I wanted to write about, because it was more than just a game, and it was more than just somebody won and somebody lost. You could write those anytime. I felt like this was a larger moment, so I knew I wanted to talk to him about it. So I went straight to the press conference, asked the first question, then I went straight to the locker room and talked to him about it some more. And he told me, yeah, he said, first off, I think it's awesome that he was sitting around.
Yeah,
deciding what he was going to tell Jim Nantz after he won a national championship. And he went out of his way to say, listen, I'm humble. I'm not trying to be arrogant, but I knew we were winning, and so I was preparing for that moment. And that he decided to use that moment not to shout out his fans or talk about how nobody believed in us, because they are the perfect nobody believed in us story, you know? Like I once heard Tyler Hansborough, after the 09 title, you know, use that same moment, literally the same moment, to talk about how nobody believed in us.
It's like, that's arguably the greatest team since 05 UNC.
They were preseason number one and the number one overall seed in the NCAA tournament. Literally everybody believed in them, okay? And yet he used that moment. So if Tyler Hansborough can use it, certainly Shabazz Napier as a 7 seed on a team that finished 3rd in the American could use a nobody believed in us. But given the moment, he decided to address an issue that's important to him. And even if he didn't state things eloquently, he stated things with a purpose. And I hope got us one step closer to realizing collectively that this system that we're using in high major college athletics is fundamentally ridiculous. Meantime, since that story ended on Monday night, we have another big story that broke this morning with UMass guard Derek Gordon announcing that he is gay, which by extension made him the first openly gay Division I basketball player in history. And Norlander, I'll start with you. You've been around that team. What sort of impact do you think this makes on college basketball?
I think, you know what? I'm not sure.
Good answer, Norlander.
He's obviously
Jesus.
I'm getting there. And by the way, first male openly gay D1 basketball player.
Yes, that's worth clarifying. Yes.
Yeah. He a solid player, really good influence on that team overall. Derek Kellogg is a tremendous coach in that program. I think he's altered a lot about that program. I think it's a fantastic story. You know, Gary, you wrote the column today on basically why, you know, this kind of thing is a worthy headline, is an important story, because eventually, and this is a good thing, the impact of this, it wears away with each announcement, and eventually there will be no headlines because we won't need any. But, you know, Gordon.
But right now it still is.
Correct. Yeah. Gordon was inspired by, you know, Michael Sam, who was inspired by Jason Collins, that kind of deal. And right now there are college basketball players playing D1 right now that are seeing what Derek Gordon's done, and they are now thinking about when will be the time that they should make some announcement like this. We will have it. I think we'll have another one of these within a year.
How about before the summer's over?
I was going to say,
how about before the summer's over?
When did Jason Collins do it?
It was last April, late April. It was less than a year ago.
Yeah. Yeah, and then Michael Sam did it recently.
He did it. He did it the day after the Marcus Smart stuff. He did it. Absolutely. Yeah. So this is terrific. More power to him. He's basically lived with this for a decade. I guess he told his parents like 10 days ago. This was the perfect time to basically tell this story, in my opinion, because it's after the rush. Like, if he had told this the Sunday before the title game, it is there, but I'm telling you, it gets so overwhelmed that a lot of people forget about it. You kind of wait for the day after to die down for college hoops. It's still in the conversation. He announces it, but he opts not to do it in the dead of summer. He opts not to do it right before the season starts. It's almost like, we're here, we understand that college basketball is just dying down. It gives us this thing that we're talking about right now. It'll be on every major site, but then by the time we get to next year, yes, it will be a story that we will write about, but it's not going to be some huge, massive thing. It'll just kind of be out there. He'll be able to be himself, and good on Derek Gordon for doing this.
I get so frustrated by readers or people who are followers on Twitter. I mean, really, when the Michael Sam one announcement happened, because you immediately had people saying, "Why is this a story? This isn't a story."
Annoys me so much. It's unbelievable.
It drives me insane. And so I just decided, like, I had things I needed to do today rather than write a column this morning. Like, I think I text messaged you guys and said, "Hey, I'm going to be out for a little while. I got to run some errands." But right. And then I was just like, I'm dropping all that. I'm going to write this because, like, for my own peace of mind. And because what you get is people saying, this isn't a story. It doesn't matter if somebody's gay. And those two things, you need to separate those sentences. You can say it doesn't matter if somebody's gay or even a basketball player's gay. I got all that. But don't tell me it doesn't matter that it's not a story. And I think you have to look no further than Derek Gordon to realize how much of a story it is. He went out of his way. Keep in mind, this is a young man who has said that he realized he was gay when he was in middle school. He's 22 years old now, so let's just round up and call it a decade. For a decade, he's been living a lie, and by his own admission, it's been hard, very difficult. He invented girlfriends. Now, I'm not telling you I never invented a girlfriend either, but he invented girlfriends. You know,
I think you still are.
I might still be. He invented girlfriends, you know, to try to throw his teammates off of his track, so to speak. And if you talk to anybody, you know, it's 2014. At this point, I don't want to say we all, because I don't have any idea, but I think most of us, you know, there's a gay person in our family, an openly gay person in our family. There's openly gay people in my family. There's openly gay people where I work. There's openly gay people everywhere. Like, you know, so we're all like, this isn't 1950s anymore. Like, people, like, we're all very familiar with these situations, to the extent that they're situations, and they go over incredibly smoothly. So it's not a big deal if suddenly you've got somebody in your office is gay, because we've all been dealing with that for a long time. But there has literally, until today, never been an openly gay Division I men's basketball player. And until a year ago, had never been an openly gay, a professional basketball player. And if you want to get specific, until Jason Collins was actually back in the NBA a couple months ago, there'd never been one. And so you listen to Derek Gordon talk about this, And he said, when Jason Collins came out, hey, I thought I wanted to come out then, but it wasn't the time. And he went on to explain, I was still sort of nervous about it because, yeah, it's great that Jason Collins came out and everybody knows he was in the NBA, but he wasn't in the NBA now. And was this going to be something that prevented that from happening? You know, right. We still didn't know how he would be treated in a locker room because, you know, presumably when he was in a locker room before, his teammates did not know he was gay, or at the very least, he was not openly gay. And so he said the turning point for him was when Jason Collins not only came out, but when Jason Collins was signed by Brooklyn, and he saw how he actually describes this moment that I remember watching live. And it's Jason Collins in LA playing for Brooklyn, you know, checking into a game and getting a nice ovation from the fans, and watching Paul Pierce and Kevin Garnett and his teammates, you know, welcome him with open arms, figuratively and literally. And Derek Gordon is on record saying, that's how I got to this moment. I didn't think I would come out for another 3 or 4 years. The reason I'm able to do this now is because Jason Collins' story was a story. And just like you said, Norlander, there's another guy out there right now who has been probably struggling with this, who has been trying to figure out if he'll ever be able to come out to his teammates, friends, family. And you know, if you're a normal guy, or more specifically, a non-basketball player, maybe it's simpler to do. But we've never known until now how somebody in a locker room would be treated under these circumstances. And what we found out with Michael Sam and with Jason Collins is that they're treated completely normally. You know, everything's cool. Everything's cooler than even the coolest people must have assumed could be. And that led Derek Gordon to this moment. So when somebody asks, why is this a story? It's because without Jason Collins' story, you never get the Derek Gordon story. And the idea that we've had three of these inside of a year, we had zero forever, and then three inside of a year, that's not a coincidence. They're all connected to each other. And that's why, you know, one day we will get to a point where it no longer resonates, or it's no longer important to write columns about these types of announcements. But right now it is still hugely important. And I struggle with people who can't grasp that for some reason.
And Borzoi, I'll let you hop in here, but we're also notice how the timeline of this is getting shorter. You had Collins, who was older and also technically out of the NBA at that moment. Then you had Sam, who was younger but out of college. Now you've actually got a person in college coming out. So what we're getting here is people that aren't having to live to be, you know, 28. Who was the first NBA guy who did it long after he retired? I played with the Magic.
What's his name?
Maybe it's even a good sign that I can't remember his name, but you know what I'm talking about, GP? The guy like 2-3 years ago?
He played for the Magic, he like retired, then he announced it.
Oh, he played at Vanderbilt.
Sure.
Yeah, John...
Yes, you're on the right track. Listeners are probably screaming it as we're doing this. It's going to drive me nuts. John Amici.
John Amici.
Anyway, you got...
I was going to say Michael Jordan. Okay. Michael Jordan. Michael Jordan was on the tip of my tongue.
You aren't having athletes that are waiting until their mid to late 20s or 30s that are announcing this. Now we're getting people in college basketball that are doing this. So that's also a good sign just for
if you read the Out Sports version of the story, just the, you know, when people say, well, why do you have to announce it? And like just some of the stories he was telling on how last summer when he liked an Instagram photo of him and a guy in front of a gay bar. And people just kind of like questioned about it, and he said he went to like depression about it. He had to go to like gay bars and clubs in New York City. People recognized him, and he like, you know, went into deep depression about that too. And that's why he had to come out. You know, people say, why do you have to do it? Why do you have to announce it? You know, that's why, because he was just so, you know, he said he's never felt worse, and he said no one should ever have to feel like that. And you know, those stories that he was telling just kind of, you know, moved me a little bit.
I don't have a single gay friend who won't tell you that being in the closet was awful and being open about it is the best feeling in the world. Not a single one. There's no exceptions to that.
You can see his face during the SportsCenter interview. You know, he seemed like a huge weight had just been lifted off his shoulders.
Literally, the first question of the interview was, "How do you feel?" And his answer was awesome.
Awesome.
The worst word out of his first word out of his mouth was awesome. And then he tweeted this earlier: "This is the happiest I've ever been in my 22 years of living. No more hiding. I just want to live." So don't ask me why this is a story. You know why it's a story? Because the first story that you were questioning, why is it a story? It led to, if nothing else on this planet, if it leads to nothing else, it led to this one individual, Derek Gordon, getting to do something, having the courage to do something that has made him the happiest he's ever been in his life. That's why it's a story. If for no other, and listen, there's 100 other reasons it's a story, but that's why that alone, it makes it well worth a story. And I actually was, I don't want to say inspired. That's overstating it. I wasn't inspired. I was basically just laying in bed. But I was moved to write it because of all of these people tweeting at me. This isn't a story. This is can't believe.
Just look at the comments on the post on CBS.
It drives me crazy. I can't. Like somebody actually just sent me a direct message. One of our friends saying, "I hope you're not looking at the comment." I can't look. Like what you realize? Okay, so I was telling somebody earlier. I was like, listen, if I can just one of these people who are tweeting at me and saying, why is this a story? If I can write 750 words and make even one of them go, okay, now I understand why it's a story, then I'll be happy. And I actually, there have been a couple of people like tweet at me and say, hey, I was one of the ones questioning why this is a story. Now I get it. So like, okay, good. Then I'm happy I wrote the column. But then still, I write the column. Okay, and I couldn't make my case any more clearly. Like you can do whatever. You can think I'm an idiot, but like the points made are pretty undeniable. And yet there're still people like this guy tweeted at me. He was like, "Still not a story." I'm like, "I can't there's nothing I can do with you then. Like I just give up on you, right? I give up on you in every way I could possibly give up on you. I just can't. There's nothing you don't have even if you want to be cuz you run into this a little bit. I mean, this is still an issue on some level rooted in religion. You know, people will I don't want to say hide behind because I don't think that's the right phrase, but people will still stand by the Bible and say that, you know, you can't agree with the sin. And I don't think I have to spend 5 minutes explaining to you what I think of that opinion. But, you know, if you have that opinion, there's still that. But even if you disagree with the lifestyle, to whatever extent you can do that in the year 2014, you can't. I don't understand how you could disagree with the point that it's a story. Like once upon a time, I guess there was somebody in America who thought women shouldn't be able to vote. You know, but when they were, it's a story. You know, no matter what. And so, it's just so frustrating. But by and large, the feedback has been really, really positive. I hope I could on some level, in my own way, crystallize that for somebody. Why? Just very. I'm not asking you to. I'm not trying to change your religious beliefs. But if you're curious why this is a story, here's why it's a story. And you know, it's really nice. Like you really do. You know, if you just look at his Twitter timeline, I mean, and watch that interview that he did,
you feel so happy for him.
You really do.
It's unbelievable.
It seems like he's not. You know, we all talk about this is the best day of my life. It really does seem like this is the best day of his life. And the idea that he's probably lived for 22 years fearing this day, the day where people would know he's gay. Think about the turn of events it must take to spend most of your life fearing this day, and then when you get to this day, actually having it be the happiest day of your life. That's a pretty remarkable deal, right?
It's absolutely it's terrific. I don't want to totally spin this the opposite way, but I feel like we should mention the other story from today, which is not happy at all, but probably deserves a quick mention. Sure. You posted on it this morning, Parrish. This one actually is kind of unreal in how fast it happened. I didn't realize it was this dire.
Neither
but
did I.
So do you want me to set it up? Do you want to set up GP or
you know the story? Tell it.
All right. So Adrian Payne befriended this young girl named Lacey Holdsworth earlier this season. Jason King wrote kind of the definitive feature on it. If you check Bleacher Report, just Google Jason King Bleacher Report Adrian Payne, and that will bring up the story. But there was a little girl, 8 years old, who had cancer, and she and Adrian Payne became like genuine friends. I mean, they kind of from the middle of the season on were seen together often. It was an extremely uplifting and touching story. She was at the Final Four. She was at
the dunk contest.
She was at the dunk contest where Adrian Payne had like this terrific showing, actually. And she like kissed the ball. She was part of the celebration. And unfortunately, she died early Wednesday morning, which is just absolutely devastating. you know, she was known as Princess Lacey. Adorable Lacey was her Twitter handle. So before we got the Gordon news, this was actually for about 2 hours the big headline in college basketball. So I just felt that, you know, her story, which you absolutely should read. If you're listening to the podcast, you've probably heard about it. But if you have not read Jason King's story, and there's plenty of stuff out there, please take the time to give it a read in her memory. Really depressing, really sad, really tragic. But when she was here and was able to inspire him and that team, I mean, Michigan State, the AD, Izzo, they all put out statements on it today. Just a tragic loss here, and just felt that, you know, she deserved a mention.
Just the worst thing in the world to wake up to. And I'm like you guys, I didn't realize that it – obviously, I knew it was serious, right? And I knew it was terminal. But she – we saw her like 5 nights ago. You know what I'm saying? Like, it wasn't like we saw her in a hospital room 5 nights ago, out in public, you know, looking as beautiful as she's looked, and seemingly as healthy as she could be under those circumstances. And so it just never occurred to me that the end was this close. And I you know, I woke up this morning to take my son to school, and I do what I do every single morning, which is, you know, I get him up, get him in the shower, and then I immediately jump on my phone to see if anything happened overnight, if there's been a resume scandal at South Florida or anything else, you know? And I see that, and like, I almost couldn't believe it. I was like, what? Like, you know, like you have to sort of like, I scrolled down some more and started doing, you know, Twitter searches for it and seeing like, is this real? Like, what? And it's just awful. You know, I live in the Memphis area, and so, you know, we have St. Jude Children's Research Hospital here, and I spent a lot of time over there. Like, I have good friends that work there. You know, they've asked me for whatever reason to come over and MC events before and spend time with the kids before. And it is truly one of the most awesome and inspiring places that you could spend the day. But it's also one of the saddest, because you're looking at these children who are, you know, as I've always said, like, it sucks anytime somebody deals with cancer, right? I mean, it's awful. But like, you know, like my grandfather died of cancer, and it sucks, right? I mean, he's my grandfather, for crying out loud. But he also smoked his entire life, and he got lung cancer. And so you can sort of connect the dots, and it doesn't make it any easier to digest, but you can at least explain it. You can connect it to something. This kind of stuff, you can't connect to anything. It's just unlucky. I mean, you know, Lacey was just unlucky. You know, like, my son, you know, fingers crossed, has been lucky to this point. Both my sons, they're like remarkably healthy and awesome. But only because they're lucky, not for any reason bigger than that. And this young girl, she got unlucky. And all these kids at St. Jude, you see them, and they're fighting, and they're doing everything they can, and their parents are just being put through it, man. I mean, you can't like, you guys aren't parents, you cannot understand what that must be like. I can't understand what that must be like. And so to see Adrian, you know, we've all watched him develop into a terrific basketball player over the years, but to see him develop into somebody who, you know, took the time to, A, even meet this girl, but then, B, develop this kind of relationship with this girl and genuinely make a difference in her life, you know, like a tangible difference in her life. I was watching videos over this morning, just crushed, there's this one thing where, you know, one moment where somebody's asking her about Adrian, and she says, every time I think of him, I smile. It was just like, you know, that's all it takes. It didn't take him like dunking a basketball for her or reading a book to her. Like, every time I think of him, I smile. And it was just the sweetest thing anybody could ever say about another human being. And I was just like, you know, it's just an awful thing to wake up to this morning.
Yeah, no, just I just felt it kind of deserved a mention. I don't know if you have to read our the most awkward segue ever, GP, but I don't know if you wanted to read the Squarespace thing. I feel like we should at least give some credence to the final. Like, Wisconsin-Kentucky was a good game. We haven't kind of talked about Kentucky yet as well. Did you want to kind of hit on the other stuff non-UConn related to the Final Four?
Well, I think it'll be interesting to see now what happens with Kentucky. I think most of us agree. And we already know Wisconsin's team's basically coming back intact. You know, Kaminsky could have theoretically turned pro, not going to. Sam Decker could have theoretically turned pro, not going to. Kentucky guys, we still don't know. Julius is gone. I think everybody understands that. Willie Cauley-Stein, as I've been told, gone. James Young, I've been told, gone. The one that the two that appear up in the air to some degree are the Harrisons, but talking to people, I'd be surprised if they're back in school. Yeah. And so it was just – I thought it was interesting.
I think the Kari Johnson is still kind of sort of up in the air. I think he does return, but he could be a first-round pick.
Of course he could, right? So, I mean, my guess is they'll have Alex Poitras, Dakari Johnson, Marcus Lee back, and then add to it a recruiting class. That is really good, but not great. Not like the one they just signed. Not like John Wall, DeMarcus Cousins. Not like Anthony Davis, Michael Gilchrist. And so it'll be interesting to see – John try to piece all this together again, because they'll be less talented than they were this year. I watched him talk a lot over the past week, and he went out of his way to explain, how difficult, that job is, starting from scratch every year under the pressure that exists at Kentucky. And there was even one moment where he said, I look at my introductory press conference from 5 years ago, and I don't look the same anymore. And it reminded me a little bit of you look at
a president, right?
You look at Barack Obama eight years ago, and he doesn't.
Exactly.
He looks 20 years older, and John looks 10 years older than he looked 5 years ago. And so, here we go again, right? They'll be good. They'll be talented. They'll be more talented than most. But, it must be awesome for somebody like Bo Ryan to sit there and go, okay, I know what I got next year. And John still, he won't know what he has for certain until they get on campus, and probably not long till after that. It's a hard way to make $5.5 million a year.
That's pretty much the way we can say it. I mean, I think all the freshmen are gone except Dakari, who obviously...
And Marcus Lee.
I meant the guys that started. You look at Dakari, and it seems like one more year, and he'll really be ready. We'll see. But for Kentucky overall, I mean... If you're a Kentucky fan, you kind of take what you got there. I mean, if it was take what you saw or chance anything else, I think you take what you saw. Up and down season, make the title game in dramatic, thrilling fashion. I mean, Aaron Harrison to have replicated what he did. I mean, in back-to-back games to hit that shot, just unreal.
Also, next year is going to be different around this time, because they're two guards they have coming in, Tyler Ulis and Devin Booker, are both – 3 or 4 year players. So I think that's going to be a good thing for them. They need some sort of continuity from year to year.
That'll be interesting to get those kind of guys in there that will be so clearly different.
The problem, of course, for those guys is that if you're a 3 or 4 year player at Kentucky,
you might get recruited over it.
Exactly.
Absolutely. They're going to recruit over your head. You'll start as a freshman and then be on the bench as a sophomore, I would assume.
How about Rex Chapman kind of just making us all kind of pause there, 30 minutes before the game actually tipped on Monday night, when he was tweeting that Cal to the Lakers was a done deal?
You can't obviously go that far with it. I mean, he could have reasonably tweeted, "I'm hearing this," but when you start throwing around done deal,
done deal to coach Mamba's Lakers was the tweet.
Listen, if the Lakers want John Calipari, I think he'll be the coach of the Lakers. I don't think there's a scenario under which he would turn down the Lakers, because
you can't turn that down. He would
tell you he'll never take a bad NBA job again, but the Lakers is not a bad NBA job. It's a bad team right now.
It's the Kentucky of the NBA.
Best case scenario, you're coaching LeBron in a year. Worst case scenario, you're coaching Kevin Love. That's the worst. You get Kevin Love to come back home to the West Coast. And so, I've said this on radio shows the past couple of days. People ask, what do you think? If the Lakers want John Calipari, he will be the next coach of the Lakers. I don't know that they do. But if they do... Yeah, he's gone, as would most people in this world. The Lakers are the Lakers, and that's a great job, and that's a great city. And so we will see. Well, listen, I know we've all got things we got to get to here. Porzello's a radio star these days, so he's got radio interviews coming up momentarily. So let's wrap this thing up. And I guess if we wanted to, we could talk throughout the summer, couldn't we?
I mean, I would still like to speak with you guys.
Yeah. I would like to speak to you as well.
Yes. Yeah, no, I'm totally. I mean, eventually we gotta. Once we know who definitely is staying and is going, we can talk about our off-season top 25 and one. Right now, Wisconsin's at 3 for Final Four teams. We got Wisconsin 3, Florida 5, Kentucky 7, and then the national champions are all the way down at 19 because obviously they lose their best player, and Daniels is certainly expected to go.
Before July, we could talk about what cities you could step on homeless people in.
Yeah, Norlander, do you want to say anything to the homeless people of America before we sign off?
Trying Anything? To think, but yeah. Okay, so Parrish wore a hat that made him look like Tyrone Biggums at the Final Four. That was ridiculous.
I look great every day.
Borzello was definitely not great every day. I'm just trying to think, what did Borzello do that we could rag on him for?
My historian's comment was pretty rough.
Oh, yeah, yeah. You want to break that down, GP?
Yeah, we were talking. I don't remember. This was after a long night. We were in in between whatever we were in between. I think this was post-dinner but pre-something. And,
this was post-dinner, yeah. Where we ate with random cops.
Oh, yeah.
Egregiously name-dropped. It was the most
random. Oh, bro. Thing. Jeez.
Yeah. Bro, jeez.
Let him eat dinner, but you know, in anonymity, not anonymity.
Yes,
there we go, Borzello.
Yeah, Randall Cobb was at our table. That is true. And Chris Webber was at the bar kicking it.
Was he really?
You didn't know that? Yeah, Chris Webber was at the bar.
I didn't see him.
Yeah. And so we were driving around, and I don't remember what I was talking about, but I was saying something about that
Ely Plaza.
Yeah, no, it wasn't. It was something about. Those who
I think we were driving past Dealey Plaza though when it all came up.
We were talking about history, and then I was using that cliche. Those who fail to understand history are, and Borzello said historians, and I was like, no, that is the opposite. Historians are people who actually understand history.
I still don't know why I said that.
You could not have answered more incorrectly than historian. Like if you were trying to pick the word that most missed. The proper answer that word was historian. So congratulations. But I will tell you that you didn't step on any unfortunate humans.
Yeah, there's no violence on my end.
It wasn't violence. I barely nudged a homeless guy. I'm not proud of it. Okay, not proud of it. GP's trying to make it sound like
just I seems like just listen. I can't speak for you. I just think
no, you can't.
I just think for me, had I stepped on a homeless person, I would have checked to see if they were okay, and then would have checked to see if there was
right.
anything.
See if you can get them a warm meal. That's all I'm saying.
Yeah, just maybe a warm meal. With that, Norlander, I have to let you go.
All right, hey, it was great seeing you guys down.
You got to take a nap, actually.
It was great seeing everybody. We'll be back at some point. I can't promise you when, but I promise you so. Take care.